Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture co-sponsored by the Humanities Foundation, the Luce Program in Scripture and Literary Arts, the University Professors Program, and the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies at Boston University. Speaking will be Robert Alter, Professor of Hebrew and Comparative Literature at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Alter received his Ph.D. from Harvard University in 1962 and has taught at Berkeley since 1967. He has published widely on the modern European and American novel, on modern Hebrew literature, and on literary aspects of the Bible. The 1995 recipient of the Scholarship Award for Social and Cultural Studies of the National Foundation for Jewish Culture, Professor Alter is the author of two prize-winning volumes on literary aspects of the Bible. Professor Alter's lecture tonight is titled, The Challenge of Translating the Bible.
A number of people asked me when I got into this business of translating the Bible, which I did more or less by accident, but I'll spare you the anecdote. Why would you want to translate the Bible? Isn't that really a redundant activity? Obviously, if you decide you want to translate something that's been translated lots of times before, it's because you think there's something really wrong with all the existing translations. And so I will begin on a negative note, but I promise to accentuate the positive later on by explaining what I think are the deficiencies of the existing translations of the Bible. I'll set aside the King James Version and come back to that later. I may have a lot of admiration for the King James Version, along with some reservations, but it fits into a somewhat different category. I would say that the various new translations of the Bible done in the second half of the 20th century by different ecclesiastical committees, that is, the New Jewish Publication Society, the New English Bible, which is Protestant, the Jerusalem Bible, which is Catholic, have been plagued by two problems: a deficient sense of the style of the Bible, and then a deficient sense of English style, which is a double whammy. If you study Bible, I may be touching, stepping on a few toes in this room, but I think if you study Bible at somewhere like Johns Hopkins or across the river at Harvard or at Yale, you will do all kinds of significant things with philological analysis and comparative Semitics and so forth, but you will never hear a discussion of style in a classroom. It isn't really a category that biblical scholars have dealt with. And I would add to that that because in the early 17th century, when the Authorized Version was done, people who were serious Hebrew scholars also had a rich literary culture, they could produce something that was vital literary English. By and large, I think the people, there are exceptions, but the people who go into biblical studies work on ancient materials. They don't read poetry very much. They don't read novels. And their own sense of English style is problematic. So let me tick off a few categories of style that I think a translator has to confront. And then I will go on in the latter part of my remarks to illustrate what I've tried to do. And I have to say, in all humility, anyone who translates a great work of literature has to see that there are obstacles you haven't overcome, that there are deficiencies, nagging points of dissatisfaction. So one's success is always uneven, and I don't claim to have solved all the problems they're going to lay out now, but at least to have made a serious try in the direction of solving them. So we have the following categories of language. There's a matter of diction, which the predominant level of the kind of diction that one finds in the Hebrew Bible in the narrative portions, I would call a kind of middle diction. That is, it for various reasons, it doesn't seem to be colloquial, but it's not a high-flown style. It's homespun, it's accessible, it uses a deliberately limited vocabulary, and I'll be coming back to that issue lately. It's concrete, and yes, it has a kind of timeless dignity. And one has to reach for an English that's an equivalent to that, so that if you try to make the Bible, as some of the 20th century translations have done, read like the daily newspaper, it just doesn't work. If, as in the new JPS translation, you have Joseph in Egypt distributing rations, then you have a tin ear, because that's the wrong semantic field and the wrong level of diction. Now, that brings me to levels of diction. There are, as far as I can make out, three distinct levels of diction in the Hebrew Bible. The one that I just described briefly for the narrative prose. Then there is the language of the dialogue, which is, on the whole, still literary Hebrew, but there are various gestures in the direction of something more colloquial, as most famously, perhaps, when the famished Esau says to his brother Jacob, "Let me gulp down some of that red, red stuff." That is, he not only says red, red instead of saying a stew or pottage, but he uses a verb for feeding that's used nowhere else in the Bible, but in rabbinic Hebrew is a verb for animal feeding or force feeding of animals. So it's obviously some kind of coarse word for feeding. So there's a dip downward toward the colloquial. And then in the poetry, we have a more archaic stratum of the biblical language, which moves upward to a specialized poetic vocabulary. And that, I think, also has to be reflected to the degree that you can in an English translation. Then there's this marvelous precision, at times a breathtaking precision, of word choice, which I don't think the translations have generally reflected very faithfully. I'll give you one example. There is a very common Hebrew verb, lahashlich, which means to fling. It has a certain edge of violence to it. Now, in the story of the banishment of Hagar with her child Ishmael, you will recall that she withdraws, once they've run out of water, she withdraws from the place where the child is so she won't see him die. And we are told in the sundry translations, she put him under one of the bushes, or she laid him down under one of the bushes. Or I think the King James says a little bit better, but not good enough. She thrust him under one of the bushes. Actually, what the Hebrew writer said was she flung him under one of the bushes. And that is the kind of daring gesture that a great writer can commit. That is, what that verb tells us is that this desperate mother is at her wit's end, and in a paroxysm of grief, she flings the child down and then retreats. I think that none of the previous translations have bit the bullet and seen the boldness of the word choice of the Hebrew writer, and that happens again and again. Then there are just three more categories in my long preamble that I think a translator has to address. There's the effective use of repetition. That is, in any body of literature where you have a limited vocabulary, and I think it's by convention limited. One way you can tell that is that there's a much richer vocabulary in the poetry. But there are only certain words, apparently, that were admissible in the prose narratives. Then you make a virtue out of a limitation by artfully repeating words and playing different meanings of the words back against one another. What the modern translations tend to do is to assume, well, English doesn't tolerate repetition, so let's think of a synonym. And as soon as you think of a synonym, you destroy the literary effect of the original. I'll give you one tiny example, sort of an extreme one. When in the story of the binding of Isaac, when Abraham is about to go up to the mountaintop, we have the following in my translation. And Abraham said to his lads, "Let me and the lad go up and worship, and we will return." Okay, now, I know that sounds a little funny. He says to his lads, that's the narrator's language, then let me and the lad. Now, the Hebrew word here is na'ar. Na'ar is a young man, or it can even be a quite small child. It's also, by extension, anyone who is in a subservient position in relation to somebody else. So it can also mean something like servant, or actually these are probably slaves. And almost all the, I think all the translations render it as servant. But the point is precisely the poignancy of the same term being used in two different senses. That is, the first sense is servant, and Abraham said to his lads. And then he says, let me and the lad, which is now a term of affection. It's the same word that David uses when he says, deal gently with the lad, Absalom, la'at la'nar Avshalom. So I think you have to go with what the Hebrew does. Two other features. I'm getting to the end of my laundry list. Rhythm. Now, this is something where I have a big quarrel with all the existing translations. I think it's maybe a universal phenomenon of literature, because rhythm is something, just as dance is universal and song is universal, rhythm is the life beat of literature, of literary language, whether it's prose or poetry. If you translate it arrhythmically, as virtually all the modern translations do, it's like heart failure. The language is no longer alive. So I actually try to approximate, not replicate, occasionally when I'm very lucky to replicate, but to approximate something of the rhythms of the Hebrew. Finally, there's a matter of syntax. Biblical syntax is more flexible than modern English syntax, but it is used for various kinds of expressive purposes, and I don't think a translator should ignore that, especially if you're not trying to make the Bible read like Newsweek magazine. If you're trying to give it a slightly archaizing coloration, you have the possibility, because we know about syntactic inversion in slightly older, not really ancient English, but English going back to the 19th century, you have this possibility in English as well. I'll give you one example. When Joseph's brothers come back up from their first visit to him in Egypt and stand before Jacob and report that Simeon is being held hostage, and they can't go back down to see the man who rules Egypt unless they bring Benjamin with them. Jacob responds in my translation as follows. Me you have bereaved. Joseph is no longer and Simeon is no longer, and Benjamin you would take, on me is all the burden. Now, the reason why I did that, me you have bereaved, is because the Hebrew syntax is unusual here. The normal way to show the direct object of a verb in biblical Hebrew is to tack it on to the end of the verb as an accusative suffix. For those of you who know Hebrew, the normal way to do this would be to say, shikaltuni. But that is not what the writer decided to do. Instead, he takes the accusative first-person pronoun, oti, and puts it at the beginning of the dialogue. Oti shikaltem. And I think this is an important feature of the characterization of old Jacob, whom I view as a kind of prima donna of paternal grief. So he puts himself at the beginning of the whole thing. Me you have bereaved. Joseph is no longer, and Simeon is no longer, and Benjamin you would take. On me is all the burden. Alai hayu kulana, like that. So this is something I try to do. Now, just a quick word about the King James Version. It is, of course, wonderful. It's a work of genius. If you ask how did a committee produce a work of genius, because they cribbed maybe 40-45% from a solitary genius, William Tyndale, who had worked about 90 years before them. It's eloquent, it's moving, and it determined the course of literary English for the next four centuries in many significant ways. But it has some drawbacks. One that will be obvious to everyone in the room is, of course, after four centuries, the language changes a lot, and we no longer understand a lot of the nuances of usage of the King James Version. Then there are inaccuracies, many small inaccuracies, and here and there some real howlers, because the plain fact of the matter is that biblical Hebrew was not understood in Christian Hebraist circles in the early 17th century nearly as well as we understand biblical Hebrew today. Finally, although everyone talks about eloquence, justifiably, in connection with the King James Version, I think by and large, it's an eloquence that is Jacobean, that belongs to the first couple of decades of the 17th century, rather than biblical. That is, it's often uses lots of syllables, lots of words, and doesn't have the compactness and the rhythmic force of the Hebrew. Like, I'll quote to you a beautiful line that everybody knows by heart, in English, from the King James Version, to illustrate, yea, though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, which is lovely. However, it's lovely as a kind of prose amble, or maybe if you want, a line of proto-Whitmanesque poetry, whereas the Hebrew says, ach ki elech begeit salmavet. It's about a third of the number of words and half the number of syllables. So, again, that compactness is something one has to at least strive for. Okay, what I'd like to do now is walk you through these examples. I'll read, but I'll stop here and there to comment, to try to explain why I made a particular decision. So let's begin with Genesis 7:6, the beginning of the flood story. Noah was 600 years old when the flood came, water over the earth. And Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives came into the ark because of the waters of the flood. Of the clean animals and of the animals that were not clean and of the fowl and of all that crawls upon the ground, two each came to Noah into the ark, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. And it happened, After 7 days that the waters of the flood were over the earth, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day, and you can see from the typography, we now have a line of poetry, all the wellsprings of the great deep burst, and the casements of the heavens were opened. Now, I want to pause for a moment over casements, because it raises the issue of diction. The Hebrew word is arubot, which clearly is a word that means windows. Rashi in 12th century French says this is fenestra in the foreign language. In other words, in Old French, it's fenêtre, the word we know. However, and by the way, in some of the modern translations, you will find something like all the sluice gates of the heavens were open, which sounds neat, but is substituting the translator's metaphor for the writer's metaphor, which I think is usually a grave mistake. But why not translate it as windows, as the King James Version does? Because there is an ordinary Hebrew word in the Bible, which is also the modern Hebrew word for window, which is chalon, which appears many dozens of times. Whereas the word used here, arubot, appears only four times in the Hebrew Bible and always in poetic texts. So you can safely assume it was not the everyday word for window, that it was poetic diction. There are reasons for thinking that it might have been an archaic word. And so I reach for a less than casual way to refer to window, casements. You find casements in Shakespeare and casements in Keats and so forth. And the rain was over the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Here I want to comment on was. That's what the Hebrew says. And modern translators tend to, they're not satisfied with that. It seems too simple, and so they'll say something like descended upon the earth or swept over the earth or what have you. But the beauty of it, I think, is in the stark simplicity. And we'll see a couple of other instances as we go on in the passage. That very day, Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth, the sons of Noah, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons together with them came into the ark. They, as well as beasts of each kind and cattle of each kind and each kind of crawling thing that crawls on the earth and each kind of bird, each winged thing. They came to Noah into the ark, two by two of all flesh that has the breath of life within it. And those that came in, male and female of all flesh, they came as God had commanded him. And the Lord shut him in. And the flood was 40 days over the earth, and the waters multiplied and bore the ark upward, and it rose above the earth. And the waters surged and multiplied mightily over the earth, and the ark went on the surface of the water. And again, the went is like the was, this simple, stark, everyday verb. And the waters surged most mightily over the earth, and all the high mountains under the heavens were covered. 15 cubits above them the water surged as the mountains were covered. Okay, I think I'm going to stop there to leave time for my other examples. The next one from Exodus 2. There are two features which I'd like to illustrate through this excerpt. The first is the terrific speed and efficiency of the Hebrew narrative, which maybe you can't avoid giving some sense of in a translation. The second has to do with word choice and repetition. And it happened at that time that Moses grew and went out to his brothers and saw their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian man striking a Hebrew man of his brothers. Of course, what might seem at first clumsy, and it's my intention to try to accustom the English reader to this, is the man-man, which, let's say, in native English style, you would almost never do. An Egyptian man and a Hebrew man. But man here, the very simple Hebrew word ish, is a thematic key word, which is going to be important in this story and also is important for the whole Moses story. There's, Moses is very strange in that he has a kind of zero-degree epithet. He's called Ha'ish Moshe, the man Moses, three or four times anyway in the course of the long narrative, as though the writer wanted to make some point that he's not a demigod, he's a man like other men. And so we have one kind of man, an Egyptian man, confronting another kind of man, a Hebrew man. And he turned this way and that and saw that there was no man about. So here's the third time. And he struck down the Egyptian and buried him in the sand. And he went out the next day, and look, two Hebrew men were brawling. And he said to the one in the wrong, "Why should you strike your fellow?" And he said, "Who set you as a man, prince, and judge over us? Is it to kill me that you mean, as you killed the Egyptian?" And now notice again the superfluous man. Mi samcha ish shofet. That is, you don't need the ish, you don't need the man, but it's clearly put in there to interact with all the previous uses of man. And Moses was afraid, and he thought, surely the thing has become known. And Pharaoh heard of this thing, and he sought to kill Moses. And Moses fled from Pharaoh's presence and dwelled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by the well. Okay, I will cut that off there, except to say that in the immediate sequel to this moment in the story, Reuel, the father of the seven young women who come to the well, it's reported to him that an Egyptian man, Ish Mitzri, came and did what he did at the well. So again, we have the highlighting of that term. Okay, now I'd like to turn to dialogue. A large part of the narrative burden in Hebrew storytelling, ancient Hebrew storytelling, is taken up by dialogue. And these dialogues, I think, are very subtle, articulated with great artistry. And when recently I taught a course at Berkeley where we read the Odyssey and Genesis, and although there are many speeches, and they're wonderful speeches in the Odyssey, there's no real dialogue. That is, people do these set performances to each other, but the point-for-point interchange, which is true dialogue, I don't think you find in Greek epic, but you find it again and again in the Bible. But let's see how that plays out here. "And Abraham journeyed onward from there to the Negev region and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur, and he sojourned in Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, 'She is my sister.' And Avimelech, the king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah," presumably into his harem. "And God came to Avimelech in a night dream and said to him, 'You are a dead man because of the woman you took, as she is another's wife.'" Now, the abruptness of that language, that is, the Hebrew is hincha met, which is really grabbing Abraham by the throat, I'm sorry, grabbing Avimelech by the throat. And I tried to get the immediacy of that by saying, "You're a dead man." But Avimelech had not come near her, and he said, "My Lord, will you slay a nation even if innocent?" Now, this sounds very strange. But here I made a deliberate choice. The Hebrew sounds very strange. That is, the Hebrew says, "Hagoy gam tzadik taharog." But why that strangeness? Will you slay a nation even if innocent? I believe that presumably he's talking about himself as the representative of the nation, being the king. But I believe that the peculiarity of the formulation is to align this story with the immediately preceding story in the narrative sequence, the story of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, where you remember Abraham has a kind of bargaining session with God, asks him if there are 50 righteous men or innocent men. He uses the same word, tzaddikim. Tzaddik is used here in the singular. And then God does destroy a whole nation. So I think we're supposed to pick up that echo, hence the peculiarity. Did not he say to me, she is my sister? And she too said, he is my brother. Now, there's a kind of stammer here, which is a stammer in the Hebrew, that is, v'hi gam hi amra. And I tried to reproduce it in the English. This is what I mean by a gesture toward the colloquial in the midst of the dialogue. That is, he's kind of sputtering with indignation. Who's at this trick that's been pulled on them, him? Okay, I think let me skip down now. You can let your eyes run over what follows in the text. Till the next morning, verse 8. And Abimelech rose early in the morning and called to all his servants, and he spoke these things in their hearing, and the men were terribly afraid. And Abimelech called to Abraham and said to him, what have you done to us, and how have I offended you, that you should bring upon me and my kingdom so great an offense? Things that you should not be done, you have done to me. And Abimelech said to Abraham, what did you imagine when you did this thing? Now, I can't resist a little remark here that does not have to do with translation. Why the repetition of the formula for introducing speech? That it's all, after all, the dialogue of Abimelech. This is something that dawned on me, alas, after a few years after I wrote my book on biblical narrative. In dialogue, whenever you have a repetition of the formula for introducing speech, and X said to Y, without an intervening response by the interlocutor, it's almost invariably, I mean, I've collected lots and lots of examples now, an indication that the second party to the dialogue has some problem about responding. Either he's embarrassed, or he's dumbfounded, or he's amazed. And so this is quite consistent. So I think this gives us a signal about Abraham. He doesn't know how to respond. So Abimelech repeats his challenging question in a kind of summarizing form. And then let's pay attention to the nature of Abraham's language when he finally responds. And Abraham said, for I thought there's surely no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. And in point of fact, she is my sister, my father's daughter, though not my mother's daughter, and she became my wife. Now, I want to explain why I chose in point of fact. He uses a rather odd adverb, omna, which is not very common in biblical Hebrew. And at least, as far as I can make out, it's a legalistic term. That is, he's beginning to hair split. He's been worked into an accord. He said, well, okay, she's not exactly my sister, but she's sort of my sister, and in point of fact, and then he makes this defense. Okay, well, what I would say as a generalization about the dialogues, that they're a good deal more lively with more psychological interaction, social interaction going on than we imagine. And if you pay attention closely reading it in the Hebrew, you can see this, and a translator has to try to get some of that across in the English. Now, I would like to move on to another feature of the style, which is rhetoric. Well, rhetoric, rhythm, cadence, all these, and repetition, all these things go together, the latter three being instruments of rhetoric. by and large, narrative prose in the Bible is not very rhetorical, precisely because it is so terse and economical. But they knew about rhetoric in the biblical world, and we have a whole book of the Bible, not the entire book, but let's say about 85% of it, which is a brilliant exercise in rhetoric, and that's the book of Deuteronomy. And of course, that is an exercise in rhetoric because it's a series of orations. That is, Moses stands before the people of Israel before just before they're going to enter the land and just before his own death, and he recapitulates the story, the great narrative that we've had in Exodus and in Numbers. He recapitulates it with a certain revisionist perspective, but that's an issue that doesn't bear on translation, and I won't get into it right now. Okay, so let's turn to, I think this is the last of the excerpts. Let's begin with verse 9. That is, the speaker is Moses, the audience is the assembled people of Israel. Only be you on the watch, and watch yourself closely, lest you forget the things that your own eyes have seen, and lest they swerve from your heart all the days of your life, and you shall make them known to your sons and to your sons' sons. The day that you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb, when the Lord said to me, assemble the people to me that I may have them hear my words, so that they learn to fear me all the days that they live on the soil, and so that they teach their sons. Now, before I go on, I want to point out that this is all one sentence, which is not characteristic of biblical style. The biblical style, by and large, uses short sentences. But precisely because of the oratorical sweep of the language assigned to Moses in Deuteronomy, there's a marked fondness for grand rolling sentences that go on for several verses in the conventional verse divisions, which I'm sure most of you understand were not original to the text. They happened in the Middle Ages. And we'll see more grand rolling sentences as we go on. And you came forward and stood at the bottom of the mountain, and the mountain was burning with fire to the heart of the heavens, darkness, cloud, and dense fog. And the Lord spoke to you from the midst of the fire. The sound of words you did hear, but no image did you see except the sound. And he told you his covenant that he charged you to do, the 10 words, and he wrote them on 2 tablets of stone. And me did the Lord charge at that time. And again, that's one of those syntactical inversions, which, like the one that I cited at the beginning of my remarks, is there in the Hebrew for emphasis. Oti tziva Adonai. That's the way it goes in the Hebrew. And so Moses has the orator has a strong sense of his own, the centrality of his own mission, which then in turn probably has a lot to do with the ideology of the Deuteronomists, but that's a different issue. Me did the Lord charge at that time to teach you statutes and laws for you to do in the land into which you are crossing over to take hold of it. And you shall be very watchful of yourselves, for you saw no image on the day the Lord spoke to you from the midst of the fire, lest you act ruinously and make you a sculpted image of any likeness, the form of male or of female, the form of any beast that is on the earth, the form of any winged bird that flies in the heavens, the form of anything that crawls on the ground, the form of any fish that is in the waters under the earth, lest you raise your eyes to the heavens and see the sun and the moon and the stars, all the array of the heavens, and you be led astray and bow down to them and worship them. For the Lord your God allotted them to all the peoples under the heavens. But you did the Lord take, another inversion like our previous ones, you did the Lord take, and he brought you out from the iron's forge from Egypt to become for him a people in a state as this day. I think I will break it off here. Now, I talked about repetition before, the repetition of the lad, or the repetition of man in the passage from Exodus. This is a different kind of repetition. It's rhetorical repetition. The technical term for this, as those of you in literary studies will know, is anaphora. You have this wonderful cascading of form, that is the Hebrew is tavnit, the form of male or female, the form of any beast that is on the earth, the form of any winged bird that flies in the heavens, the form of anything that crawls on the ground, and so forth. And of course, there's also a recapitulation of Genesis, contrary to some biblical scholars who like to rearrange radically the chronology of the composition of the books. I feel quite confident that the author of Deuteronomy was familiar with something like the P version, the priestly version of the creation story in Genesis, and is citing it here. And you will note all those terms and how familiar they are from the beginning of Genesis. And of course, this particular use of anaphora, of the insistence on form, serves not only an emotive purpose, but I would say an ideological purpose, because the Deuteronomist is radically anti-iconic. I mean, one of his great theological obsessions is making images out of material substances and then worshiping them. So the horror of making these forms of various pieces of nature of the created world is gotten across through the anaphora. Now, in conclusion, what I'd like to do for my last extended example, which I don't think I asked to be replicated, I'm not quite going to stop and comment on it in the same way, is I felt that in order to give you some sense of the full spectrum of problems that a translator of the Hebrew Bible faces, I ought to give you one example of poetry. And so let me say a few swift words about Hebrew poetry, ancient Hebrew poetry. It works, as we've understood since the 18th century, maybe even a little earlier, roughly speaking, on parallelism of meaning between the two, or sometimes there are three parts of the line. That is, if you say Jacob in the first half of the line, you say Israel in the second half of the line. If you say house in the first half of the line, you say dwelling place in the second half. It's actually a lot more interesting and complicated than that, because all sorts of fascinating developments occur between the first half and the second half, but I won't trouble you with that. But what I want to do is highlight the rhythmic aspect, which is a special problem for a translator. That is, usually there is either the same number of accented syllables, let's call them beats, in each half of the line. And a typical pattern is 3-3. And then you have variations like 3-2. And occasionally you'll have 2-2. Often, because biblical words are short, there's no more than one unaccented syllable, or the most two, in between the beats. So the lines are very compact. And that compactness is extremely hard to reproduce in English because the structure of the two languages is so different. Now, so I've tried to do something with the compactness, although it's not quite the same as the Hebrew, certainly. The other thing I want to say has to do with God names in the poetry. You will hear a couple of other God names here, which are not translated. What I'm going to be quoting from is Balaam's oracles in the Book of Numbers. He uses a number of different names for God, and he uses the name El, which is a simple Hebrew word that means God, but I don't translate it. I use a capital E-L because it's a name co-opted or borrowed, depends how you want to look at it, from the Canaanite pantheon. El was the sky god. And remember, this is a non-Israelite prophet. So I want to get some of the ancient Near Eastern archaic coloration. So when he says El, I say El. When he says Shaddai, I say Shaddai. This occurs in Numbers 23. Balaam is on the mountaintop. He's conducted this elaborate hocus-pocus with seven altars and seven sacrifices. And Balak, the Moabite king, is waiting breathless for a first-class hex to be put on Israel. And of course, instead of the hex, we get a blessing. From Aram did Balak lead me, the king of Moab from the eastern mountains. Go curse me, Jacob. Go doom Israel. What can I hex that El has not hexed? And what can I doom that the Lord has not doomed? From the top of the crags do I see them, and from the hills do I gaze on them. Look, a people that dwells apart amongst nations it is not reckoned, who has numbered the dust of Jacob, who counted the issue of Israel. Let me but die the death of the upright, and may my aftertime be like his. I can't resist a comment on my choice. The diction here, the English diction, is largely Anglo-Saxon. There are words like hex and doom. And I chose hex because the root kof bet hey, is a very rare biblical word for cursing. And I thought that the everyday curse was too common. But you gain two advantages by using Anglo-Saxon diction rather than Greco-Latinate diction. You cut the syllables down because many Anglo-Saxon words are monosyllables, and you get a certain antique flavor to the language, which I think is appropriate precisely for this archaic poetic diction of biblical poetry. Okay, two more oracles, and I will cease and desist. The next oracle. Rise, Balak, and listen. Give ear to me, O Tzipor's son. El is no man who would fail, no human who would show change of heart. Would he say and not perform? Would he speak and not fulfill it? Look, to bless I was taken, and he blessed, so I will not reverse it. He has beheld no harm in Jacob, and has seen no trouble in Israel. The Lord his God is with him, the king's trumpet blast in his midst. El, who brings them out from Egypt like the wild ox's antlers for him. For there is no divining in Jacob, no magic in Israel. Now be it said to Jacob and to Israel what El has wrought. Look, a people like a lion arises, like the king of beasts rears up. He will not lie down till he devours the prey, and blood of the slain he drinks. Okay, that's very sanguinary. This is ancient Near Eastern martial poetry, and it doesn't pull punches. It relishes the idea of tearing the enemy to shreds. And in order to balance that, I will read a final oracle, which does have its martial poetry, but also has its lovely Pacific poetry, including lines that some of you will be familiar with because they were introduced into the daily Jewish liturgy. They begin every morning's prayer. Utterance of Balaam, Beor's son. Utterance of the man open-eyed. Utterance of him who hears El's sayings, who the vision of Shaddai beholds, prostrate with eyes unveiled. How goodly your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel. Like palm groves they stretch out, like gardens by a river, like aloes the Lord has planted, like cedars by the water. Water drips from his branch, and his root in abundant waters. His king looms over Agag, and his kingship is lifted high. El, who brings him out from Egypt like the wild ox's antlers for him, he consumes nations, his foes, and their bones he does crush and smashes their loins. He crouches, lies down like a lion, like the king of beasts. Who can rouse him? Those who bless you are blessed, and your cursers are cursed. Well, as I say, a translator, maybe even better than his audience, when he or she reads the translation out loud, can see things that work, and then the warts and all part. So it's not perfection, but it's at least a stab at trying to confront those issues of style that I laid out at the beginning, which, alas, I don't think the translators that have dominated the last few decades have done. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture titled The Challenge of Translating the Bible. Speaking was Robert Alter, professor of Hebrew and Comparative Literature at the University of California, Berkeley. Tonight's lecture was sponsored by the Humanities Foundation, the Luce Program in Scripture and Literary Arts, the University Professors Program, and the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette with help from Vince Fairchild. Our web producer is Angel Cuzzelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.